Welcome to the Church Safety and Security Broadcast with the Church Safety Guys. Brought to you by TwoWayRadioCenter.com, a Motorola value-added reseller. The Church Safety Guys is a nonprofit organization dedicated to equipping the vigilant, those men and women who stand watch, keeping our houses of worship and places of faith safe. We believe church safety and security must be a ministry first, and have engaged servant leaders who continually strive for excellence and teams of motivated volunteers that are always training. Join us for the next hour as the Church Safety Guys unpack safety, security, leadership, and ministry operations with your hosts, Dr. James McGarvey and Mike Scully. This broadcast is also available on YouTube, your favorite podcast platforms, ChurchSafetyGuys.com, and on the original Church Security app. Download it today. Feel free to like, subscribe, and share with your ministry.
Well, hello. Welcome to the Church Safety and Security Broadcast with the Church Safety Guys. I am James, and once again on this broadcast, joined by my co-host, Mike.
How are you doing, sir?
I am doing well. I'm doing better than last week.
That's good. That's good.
I was really looking forward to the chat with you and Jared and on Easter prep. And yep. I was at church and I don't know. I think a Mack truck hit me or something, but I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was wrapping stuff up, getting ready to go home. And I'm like, my sinus just started pounding and I'm like, okay, there's no way that, and I started losing my voice too. I could barely talk. So we were eating lunch with our pastor and his wife, and he looks at me like across the table and he's like, are you going to be able to do your broadcast tonight? He's like, you can't even talk. And when your pastor says that to you, it's like,
nope. You know,
okay. So that was the point where I messaged you guys and I felt bad bailing. But as soon as I got home, I literally, it was one of those things where I think I went to bed at like 8 o'clock and slept straight through. So
yep.
Usually if you can do that, you know that your body needs it and you're tired. Yep. So,
yeah, it is one of my favorite episodes we do of the year. And I know we kind of do one of those every year and kind of do one around Christmas and so forth. And really there's not a whole lot different between the Easter and Christmas episodes necessarily, other than you may have different baselines, different weather, different other pieces that factor in. I mean, you're not having egg drops at Christmas, but you're also not necessarily having ice conditions at Easter either, in most cases. Now, yeah. Some of y'all up in the Northeast, pleasure to have gotten out of that area. Myself may still have some snow and ice remnants, but it is an early Easter this year, but I do love the episode. I mean, it was great. And if you haven't had a chance to check it out, be sure to do so. It really is a good to get you in the right mindset for Easter, and that's coming up real quick. So you're running out of time to really prepare, but honestly, there's never a bad time to listen to that episode to prepare, because even if you listen into it after Easter, you know what you're getting a jump on next year.
Absolutely. And it is one of those topics. You guys hit some fantastic points with it. And I think I'm going to retire and the two of you can take over the broadcast. So yeah, you're like laughing.
1, 2, 3, not it.
Yeah. But anyhow, if this is the first time you've joined us, or maybe it's been a little while, welcome. Thanks for hanging out with us. As always, you can reach out to us through our website, which is churchsafetyguys.com, or you can connect with us through our YouTube channel, click like, subscribe, and be notified of new content, which is typically every week. Or you can actually stream this and listen to it through the Church Security app, which is available free to download, free to register, thanks to some of our sponsors. And That's through the Google or iOS platforms. So, and there's a lot of free resources on there as well that typically we put on there and make available. But if you have any questions about that content or would like a hard copy of it, just reach out to us through our website and we can email you that information or help you out appropriately. So real quick, before we jump into the topic, because I want to give enough time to cover it, hopefully, and cover it well. I do want to mention the Church Security Essentials Conference in Austin, the end of April. That is now a two-day conference. You don't want to miss it. We are quickly selling out tickets. We've already actually sold out of the VIP meet and greet, which is awesome. But we have a few new sponsors, a few folks that have stepped in, which is great as well. And we've got a very dynamic lineup of Friday sessions, and then Saturday is our normal conference with a whole host of some seasoned speakers and some new speakers. But regardless of where your team is at on its journey of doing well and being a safety team, maybe it's not even a safety team yet. Maybe you're still trying to figure out the best way to start a team for your house of worship. Even in that preemptive, I guess, place, there's information and there's great content from our folks that you don't want to miss. And these are all fantastic individuals that are experts in their area and just do a phenomenal job with their content and are sought after. So I always feel blessed. It's a great week. Very busy, obviously, but it's always fun to get to see everybody and hang out. And we don't always get that opportunity to live all over the place. So,
I mean, not just for us. I mean, think about it, in any safety security member or leader, how often are you given an opportunity to kind of be in the same room as others who have the same calling, others who are serving in the same ministry? It creates an opportunity to kind of, you know, they say birds of a feather flock together. Well, this is the type of opportunity where you're bringing that mission together. And while your church is different and unique, and you may have different circumstances for your team, there's still a whole lot of commonality. And that's not just in the fact that we're rooted in Christ's calling and protecting and serving the church, but also in procedures and policy and what we need to do in our job to keep our houses of worship safe.
For sure. So on this broadcast, on this topic, we're going to bring up the topic of, I labeled this as episode, if I can speak, as when kids don't listen, when verbal de-escalation doesn't work. And the reason I did that, and the reason that I had a lengthy discussion with our guest that I'll bring in here in just a second, is really because we've started seeing a few folks out in the church safety world ask the question, you know, what do you do when you're trying to de-escalate, especially kids, and it doesn't work, like it doesn't happen? Well, there's different levels, obviously, there's different levels of de-escalation. And so that's why I intentionally use the word verbal, because we're going to talk about that a little bit too, with different options and whatnot on this broadcast. But I do want to say, starting off, like typically any broadcast that we do, you know, if we're speaking to our knowledge base and our knowledge of law in our states, specifically in this area. And so what I would encourage you to do, like I would any other time, is do the research in your home state, find out the law and what the law says in your home state and what obligations are for your church. And make sure that I'm happy. I'm thrilled that you're listening to us for our content. We're going to talk about stuff and offer some best practices. But at the end of the day, you need to get training from an individual that's local to your state, that's familiar with your state laws and can help you. And sometimes, depending on the state, sometimes we can help you navigate to that person. But at the same time, just keep in mind that that would be our disclaimer for this episode, and past discussion or experiences that we talk about aren't necessarily always applicable to every situation. So you need to just remember that you in your situation, you have choices to make, and we want to make sure that you make the best that you can from where we're standing. But at the same time too, you need to make sure that you're knowledgeable and trained in certain ways that we talk about to accept responsibility for that. So
absolutely. I kind of want to add it to our own bit of disclaimer. I think in the, as I was looking at this topic and really kind of saying, all right, this could be a doozy. This definitely is one of those areas where I expect hate mail, frankly, because it's one of those people have strong opinions on one way or the other. And that's okay. Have those opinions. But the idea is that just because you think you're right doesn't mean the other person's also wrong. This is one of those areas. Absolutely. There's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of legalities. There's a lot of unique distinctions. And honestly, words matter. So at the end of the day, your interpretation of a word we use could be completely different than our intent behind how we use the word. So be really Absolutely. Careful before reacting to today's episode, because it really can be something that you need to listen to twice before reacting. I think that's one of those things. And I really want to call out the distinction that what we're talking about here, this is not discipline. Okay. This is not at all discipline. This is not, hey, somebody didn't listen to XYZ and therefore they're calling the safety team in to discipline a child. That should not be the safety team ever. That is not our job. Absolutely. That is not our scope. That is not our ministry. That is not our mission. And if you have a church, a leader, a team member, whatever, that's trying to have you step in a disciplinary fashion, then you need to stop cold in their tracks, because you're already going down a path of no return.
And to that point too, and that's an excellent point, is, you know, silence is complacency, right? So if somebody even jokes about, hey, we need you to come take care of this kid or this in a disciplinary way, be serious, because that's happened. I mean, that's happened to me numerous times where I've said, you know, that's really not our responsibility. That's not what the safety team does. And it's okay to say that. And it's okay to be firm and polite in saying that. But sometimes even people joking isn't acceptable when it comes to disciplining a child and handling a child. What we're talking about in this type of situation is where, and for this episode, is when you have to step in, whether the child has special needs or not, and mitigate the child from harming themselves or doing something different. So as we talk about that, just keep in mind too, to Mike's point on the gray area, there is a lot of gray area. How I handled or chose to handle a scenario or situation or a guest or Mike is different from how you might choose to handle that scenario. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But keep in mind that just like if we were talking about self-defense laws and gun laws, in the application of self-defense laws, I would tell you and I would say, look, Texas laws are different from Ohio's laws. They're similar in some capacity, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the law is. It matters with the intent behind that.
Right.
And so, you know, from Mike's standpoint, if he uses a firearm to defend himself or his family, what's his intent? And that's not something I can evaluate over the air. That's something that law enforcement and other professionals are paid to do. So that all being said, I'm going to go ahead and bring in our guest here, which is really, he's not a guest. So he's really more like a family member. but for those of you listening, John Riley with General Response has joined us for the active discussion. And I'm thrilled to have the discussion with you, John, and I appreciate your time and coming on and hanging out with us.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Good to see you, John.
Hey, Mike. Yeah. Hey, can I just say something real quick? You made a comment around a while ago that absolutely hit home from a former, as a former law enforcement. Many times parents are calling us to go discipline their children. And it would just upset us because that's not our job. And it just continues. Number one, it continues to create more dysfunction in that family because now the kids are like, oh, mom's going to call the cops on us or whatever. And just continues the fuel, I guess, the negativity in the culture. And there was a time when it was funny to come across police officers at a restaurant or whatever and jokingly say out loud, hey, you know, if you don't act up, you know, police are going to get you. At one time, that was funny. That's not funny anymore.
Right.
No. And it really, really would bother us. And we would go to a house and as my partner's talking to the juvenile or I'm talking to the juvenile, my partner's, and I've done this several times, I pull a parent aside and go, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, now you're calling the police on your child. And I'm trying to get them to really think ahead of the ripple effect of that call and that, it's, yeah. Anyway, that's another rabbit hole.
I understand 100% because I've seen that before. I've worked with officers in the field where they've said that. They've said, you know, we've had a parent that said, hey, you know, don't do anything bad because so-and-so is a police officer or so-and-so is a cop and they'll take you away. And even in when you're dealing especially with children, whether they have special needs or they're just a regular child, oftentimes, like I've been at church in my kids department when individuals, you know, and just my safety polo shirt or a lanyard or whatever, individuals will come up to me, children will come up to me and say, hey, are you a police officer? And so there's a respect thing there. And oftentimes I'll say, no, I'm not, but I work with police officers a lot and I work with other folks here at the church. And then they're like, oh, okay. You know, but there's that gap and that bridge to be able to say, look, I'm not, my intent isn't to discipline. My intent is to help and to help mitigate something that's maybe not going right or not going well. And yeah, that's an excellent point and something that I think a lot of times we say or do that sort of thing without thinking about the implication of it. But, you know, the truth is as a safety team and all of us serve in that capacity at our churches, we want kids to be able to trust us like they would trust authorities. But at the same time, we also need to be guarded and ensure that we're doing things the correct way and in a God honoring, but also individual honoring way too.
Yep. There's a difference, I think, in overall how we approach this. And here's the difference. Whether you're a church that is much more overt or whether you're 100% covert, that matters in the topic here tonight. I think if you're overt, the mere presence of yourself in some sort of identifying uniform can be interpreted as a show of force. So when we're talking about any sort of escalation, while we're, of course, trying to de-escalate, just know that our presence, safety showing up to something, there's already things that have failed for us to have to get there. So let's take that into account.
Absolutely. Yep. So let's go ahead and jump into it. And I like the idea and I like the concept of saying, like I mentioned before, John, that, you know, de-escalation isn't always verbal. And I know we've talked about that before. A lot of times it's, you know, it's visual, it can be verbal, but it's also your body language, how you present yourself. And like Mike said, just showing up sometimes is an authority presence in some cases to de-escalate. But tell us what you think about that type of situation. Let's start with kids outside of special needs, like just a regular Sunday school class type thing. Like what would your recommendation be with like trying to work with a situation?
I'm based on my own experiences and observations, I think it is absolutely key that whoever the adults are, the volunteers are, talking about a church children's ministry environment, you have to have is beginning to get agitated and stressed. If you allow that to get to the point where they have an explosion, well, you were kind of way past de-escalating now because it's now blown up and now you're playing catch up. But as soon as you can sense, okay, Johnny and Jeff there are, you know, for whatever reason, they're usually best friends, but they're beginning to bump heads, and you let it go too long and it becomes a physical fight, well, now we've had this explosion. But if we can somehow start to intervene, distract, begin the de-escalation process, starting with maybe separating them and or beginning with just your presence, they suddenly realize you're standing 5 feet away watching them. Some, you know, just that. However, if mere presence on the use of force continuum isn't working, well, now we're going to have to say something, some type of verbal command. Hey, guys, cut it out. Or John, go sit over here or something like that. But be aware that there's some type of tension and stress happening, because if you wait too long, well, we're way past de-escalating now and we're trying to pick up the pieces. Not that it's not impossible, but obviously the challenge is just that much greater, because now the child, the juvenile, is really spiking emotionally, you know.
Sure.
So situational awareness, I think, just to answer your question right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's two aspects to that, to come off of what you said. I think there's an aspect of, you know, the teacher trying to do the best that they can, mm-hmm. and accidentally mm-hmm. maybe escalating the situation because they don't know that information, and being in that place where all of a sudden Johnny's in the classroom and, maybe he's on medication. Maybe there's a behavioral issue there. I mean, we don't always know that information. Sometimes we do, and we can kind of preempt, like you said, preempt it and realize, okay, you know what? There's an attention deficit disorder here, or there's something else. Let's have a little bit more grace, a little bit more patience in dealing with the child, or maybe how he or she interacts with others. But oftentimes what I've seen is when safety and security gets called, it's already something where, you know, it's exploding, that the child is causing potentially harm, you know, harmful situation to themselves, to the teachers, throwing chairs, you know, throwing themselves, hurting themselves type thing. But what's interesting to me is oftentimes teachers, in the conversations that I've had, teachers don't know what they don't know. And in many cases, they can cause the problem to get worse because they're not realizing. Like I've seen a teacher actually stand in front of a child who was special needs, that had no intention of sitting in a chair because they were special needs. And the teacher stood there clapping their hand, like, you know, trying to get their attention and saying, okay, sit down, you need to sit down. And I walked up and I said, that's not how he communicates. That's not how he responds to information. Mm-hmm. So I watched the thermostat on the teacher go up and up and up, mm-hmm. till the point where mm-hmm. that teacher was so frustrated with what was happening that they were not in a position to do good. I mean, just to say that, like, they were allowing stuff to escalate further, because they weren't controlling themselves and, you know, and reining that in. So, but go ahead.
You've heard me say it before. I'll say it again. When you allow yourself to become frustrated, impatient, or offended, you dramatically increase the likelihood that you're going to say or do something that escalates it. And that's a perfect example of a teacher meaning well, meaning to do good, but not truly understanding, doesn't know what she doesn't know. And she's getting herself frustrated and jacked up because why isn't this child being compliant? And then in the next few moments, whatever comes out of her mouth or whatever she does next is probably going to be a total escalation of that situation, especially if we're talking about a special needs child. My daughter, as you know, is autistic, recently went for a minor surgical procedure, and she would not sit down on the bed in the gurney in the room so that they could get an IV into her. All they needed was for her to sit down. But it was an enclosed environment, strangers, She just wasn't being compliant. I knew that I should just leave the room to reduce the number of people in the room. But a few moments later, the anesthesiologist came in, the OR nurse came in, people kept crowding in there, and my daughter continued to be non-compliant. She wasn't acting out. She was just not compliant, and everyone else was getting jacked up. And I know she could sense it. Mm-hmm. And finally the nurse came out and I said, "Hey, when you guys have a moment, just no one say anything to her. Just give her some moment." Everyone else had left. It was just Lisa and the nurse went back in, and she came out a few moments later and she said it worked. As soon as everyone stopped giving her all this stimuli and all that, and as soon as everyone walked out of the room, she sat down and boom, they got the IV line in her and everything, you know, domino effect. But it was those initial moments, and actually it lasted almost an hour and a half, where people were getting frustrated. And I was standing outside trying to communicate with people. At first, it didn't hit me that that's probably what was going on, where people were going in there, checking in on her, and they were kept talking at her. Even though they were using a kind, soft tone of voice, it was still having an opposite effect. She just wanted to just, you know, not be compliant with everything that was going on. But as soon as everyone just stopped talking, the room was silent for literally 20 seconds, she sat down and then was compliant with everything else. When you're dealing with people with special needs and all that, and you've heard me say this, and this is really, it was my experiences dealing with juveniles and so on myself, that I suddenly realized the commonality of basic human psychology, regardless of the age of the person I'm dealing with. Mm-hmm. Deep down inside, the little primal you is looking at the world and wondering, does it look like a threat? Does it sound like a threat? And as long as you play your ace card, you don't come across looking like a threat, sounding like a threat, there's less reason for that person to get juvenile. In this case, we're talking about young person. It's less reason for them to get that much more jacked up, and you can begin the de-escalation process. But all parents, we've all been there. Our first exposure to dealing with a younger person, a smaller person, is with our own kids. Well, in that type of intimate setting, it's easy for us to become frustrated when our own kids are not being compliant or they act up or whatever.
In that type of situation, I'll just say this real quick and throw it over to Mike. But in that type of situation, it's also okay to step back and say, I need to step back. Like I need, because I'm too invested in this situation and I'm getting frustrated. And there have been several times where I've done that, where less is more. And you know what? One person is doing a fantastic job and I don't need to be there because this child just tried to bite me or headbutt me or something unintentional, but still, you know, I need to. In that type of situation, children, whether they're special needs or not, can certainly feel are more emotionally invested and can feel if you're not in control of your attitude and your actions.
Absolutely.
And attitude. So
absolutely.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tie off of that real quick and then go where I was going to go. I think regardless of our role or title, tapping out is never a shameful thing. I think it's actually the opposite. It's a wise thing to do when you're actually saying, you know what, this is not my time, not my moment, not my race, whatever. You realize that there can be a time where for whatever reason, you can be doing everything right, but your presence, your tone, whatever reason is a trigger for that other individual. And therefore, again, we talked about presence earlier. The difference is, again, you can be doing it right and still be a trigger. That's your opportunity to tag out, and that's your opportunity to kind of really get to the heart of the matter. So going back to where you went, John, and I too have a autistic child and have learned new things each and every day. I don't know that I'll ever uncover enough learning to feel comfortable, but at the same point, it's what we try to learn from. And so I feel like in that sense is like, we should almost assume going into a children's room or situation in church that it's actually very likely that someone in that room is not neurotypical. I mean, nowadays, that's really the difference. Now, it's not necessarily saying that the person involved in a situation that we were called in for is neurotypical or not neurotypical in that sense, but really saying is that we need to understand that what we're walking into as individuals may not be something we're as exposed to. And so in those circumstances, that's a perfect opportunity to recognize, hey, I don't know how to respond here because I'm not equipped to respond effectively in this specific situation. Now, whether that's a child escalating that is neurotypical or whether it's a child that isn't. And now as a result, you're saying, you know what, I have methods for helping in the situation when a child is a risk to themselves or others. But because of the compounding implications here of this child having additional needs, you know what, there may be a situation that just says, guys, this is not my time to serve here. And there's another good play here is that sometimes that tone and our nature of being in a safety and we're already kind of adrenaline rolling when we're called on the radio to come activate and respond to a situation. Well, we got to understand that when we're walking into kids' church and maybe have had to walk partially across the church to get there, we've escalated ourselves and ramped ourselves before we even walk through that door. Breathe, Absolutely. Take a moment and go in. Unless they're immediately a threat to somebody and those seconds matter, take a pause before you even engage.
Absolutely right.
And really to that point too, one thing that you said, Mike, to go back to the neurological concerns, what's interesting, and I don't understand why more people don't understand what I'm about to say, but the truth is that every individual, if they are special needs or not, like if they've never been tested, maybe they have, you know, a learning curve, or maybe they're different. Every child is different, right? So my point is, what I'm trying to get to is, every child is different. Every situation is different. So you can group best practices in your mind approaching a child. But again, you don't know until you actually interact with the child what that child finds is triggering and doesn't find is triggering. So if I run across the church and walk into the kids area, you know, with keys and belt jiggling, you know, and all this stuff falling off of me because, you know, I ran across the church to get there because of that call, I need to stop, because all of a sudden now I'm putting intensity into a situation that already has intensity, but I don't know, just because I've dealt with or had situations with other previous special needs kids, I don't know that what I learned or did in that situation is still going to work in this situation. Now, there are certainly things that can trigger, and being calm and patient never hurt any situation, like to stop and take a breath and say, okay, you know, what are we going to do here? How are we going to fix this? Is this an inconvenience thing? Because I know that there have been times at one of the churches I attended years ago, there were times where if it was a behavioral issue, the Sunday school teacher would call us and say, you know, I need you to come take care of this kid for me. And that's when it like morphed into a disciplinary thing. It's not that you're patient with the child to have the child sit down and listen. It's okay, now you're calling me to discipline the child. And let's just be honest, you know, kids like to see action. Kids like to see drama. So the fact that somebody else is dealing with them than the norm, that's cool to them, right? So it's like, okay, so you just got called in there. You're added to that environment. If this child has no structure and is looking to build on the drama and create a more dramatic situation, you just played right into what they're trying to do, because at that point they're looking for that attention. You just added, you know, twofold to that situation. So it's pretty, I don't know, it's pretty challenging and pretty rough, but my honestly, and I'll just throw out one of my best practices and then we can move on. But I would honestly say your best practice or your best tool is realizing that every situation is different. Like there is not a way to categorize every single situation and be prepared for that. So what are you being prepared for? Well, be prepared that every situation is unique to that child, to that environment, to that situation, and sometimes to that day. Because like I said, if a child didn't have their medication, or maybe they're having a rough day and, you know, they're acting out, or maybe it's not intentional. Maybe they're having a reaction to medication. I've seen that before as well. That's not something that you just ignore, but keep in mind that there's no, oftentimes there's not a black and white response or answer when, you know, handling that type of situation.
Or maybe that, the fire alarm went off, or maybe they played a loud song, and maybe they incorporated some lights and things that they've never had before in that kid's room. Any number of things, because sensory processing is also an issue. And I think there can be times where just removal of the controlled senses that are overwhelming the child can be the de-escalation method. So it's not necessarily removing them from the situation. It's removing the situation that is being the trigger.
That's why my daughter has headphones put on, and a lot of autistic kids have headphones. You'll see them walking around in public areas wearing headphones just to muffle the audio and auditory type stimulus that could be very stressing for young people. You know, you hit upon a point I make in all my classes. Slow down and take a breath. Don't just go rushing into a situation. Slow down and assess the situation, and stay flexible, because by the time you get to where you're heading, the situation may have dramatically evolved. I experienced that firsthand. I get a call. I look on my computer dispatch screen. It says such and such. By the time I get there, it's evolved. It's something else, or it's worked itself out, or it's worse, whatever. But the point is, slow down. Do not assume that because A happens, or you think A is happening, that you just go to B. You've got to stay flexible, and that's exactly right. And just remember, the basics. If you come across to especially a young person who's shorter than you, smaller than you, weaker than you, you are going to come across looking like a threat to them, and you could be chasing them all over kingdom come just because they're afraid of you now, because your body size, your body posture, the facial expression, and so on. And we've all had that situation with our kids. You ask your kids after you catch them, where are you running to? I don't know. But they just know deep down inside they had to run away from the danger.
Well, and the other aspect of that too is you risk making yourself look like an idiot. Mm-hmm. And not that we all are concerned about that on a regular basis, to add some humor to it. But I mean, think about it outside the box of, you know, responding a safety team. If your church already has concerns with having a safety team, and you go respond to a situation and look unprofessional and ill-equipped handling that unique situation, then that can do, from a relationship standpoint to the culture of the church, that can do more damage than good. So, you know, if you aren't comfortable, and again, I'll reiterate this and then throw it over to Mike, but if you're not comfortable handling that type of situation, then you need to do a quick scout through your church and figure out, you know, if your church has a special needs ministry, if there are individuals maybe you can partner with to understand better, or be better prepared. But that's, you know, that's definitely something you want to look at.
Yeah, I mean, just to close out really on the special needs element, I mean, learning disabilities, autism spectrum conditions, sensory processing disorder, mental health difficulties, all of those children that may be in those situations are more at risk of any intervention that we could apply than a neurotypical child. So understand that is a variable that we don't know walking in. That you could sit there and say, you know what, I'm in control, I'm in command, I'm in charge, and you know what, I can go right into this and say, I can handle this situation. but you may realize that that variable is there, and you need to recognize that this is perhaps yet an entire different area of learning that your safety team has not considered, that is absolutely critical, becoming more and more important. And you have to understand that says, if you don't have those skills, your church is lacking. So I know we talk about churches that, you know, we only got one or two people in our team. Well, guess what? One is good. Okay. But one without the right skills is not very good at all. It really matters about skill set, and it's quality, not quantity. So I wanted to just tie a bow around that piece for a second and transition into really likelihood. And so looking at it from a standpoint, we're still in a church setting. We're not out on the street. We're not talking a school classroom that's typical in any situation. So we're saying that really in a church setting, you're much less likely that you need to assume the worst that you're walking into. In fact, we should be assuming the best in someone, especially in a child-involved situation. But understand that we need to seek additional information before and while we're engaging, that it's not a simple decide and act. We must be orienting continually, especially when we're moving into a kid's situation.
And can I say, dealing with children, especially in this day and age, is probably right now with everything going on in the world, having a ministry mindset is probably even more extra critical right now, because you're going to be the example to them on how to effectively handle stress. You're going to lovingly show them where the boundaries are, what the consequences are. But if you go barking at them because you're frustrated as an adult that this child is being noncompliant and all that, it's possible that you're just mirroring a dysfunctional household that they already came from. And one of the things I tell people, the counselors and all that at our kids camp every summer, hey, you need to make sure you understand that this week is probably the one week out of the year that they feel safe enough to try to be a kid. Yes, they're going to try to test boundaries, but how you react and respond with the ministry mindset can absolutely change the arc of their life and plant seeds in their life. And you've got to remember, again, and that's why I learned from my own experiences and observations, simply just play your ace card. It's the human, basic human psychology remains the same. It's underdeveloped in young children. It gets more developed in time as they become adults. Everyone wants to be treated with dignity and respect, and they can sense that. You start coming across heavy-handed to them by your tone of voice or your body posture, you're looming over them or something, trying to intimidate them, then you're really not being as effective, I think, being godlike than you probably could be.
For sure. I think there's a couple of different situations that I think have happened, or scenarios that have happened to me over the course of running a safety team at a church for almost 18 years, but I'm thankful that one of the keys to that church is that they do have a special needs program. They have a special needs room, and they've invested a great deal of time into creating safe places throughout. Like when we redid our kids department, there was very specific intentions that were put into tactile walls and different things, you know, for sensory kids, but then also for non-special need kids, and just being there and being helpful. And I appreciate that. I know there are a lot of churches out there that don't necessarily, embrace that, and kids end up kind of being like off to the side, not really an important thing. But the truth is that if you can interact with the kids ministry, if your safety team can interact with the kids ministry in a positive way, that goes far, far more, you know, and does far more good than having a specific room or a specific person. And honestly, one of the things that over the course of 18 years, one of the things that I did was at one point I realized, you know what? I just don't have enough training. I don't know how to handle this type of situation where, you know, a child hits me or strikes me or, you know, does something like that, what, you know, what can I do? What can I not do? And I want to talk a little bit about the use of force and get into a little bit more specifics on that, because every situation is so different. And I know sometimes people will say, well, what should I do? How should I handle this type of situation? Like maybe a child is hitting me or trying to bite me or something along those lines. Every state that I've seen, and I haven't reviewed them all, but I will say from my experience, every state that I've seen, there is a great risk with using force. And that risk is that you have the obligation to prove that that amount of force that you used was justifiable in the situation. And I can tell you that from personal experience that using force with a child is far more complicated than using force with an adult. And part of that is because with an adult, you look at that person as an equal, but oftentimes with a child, now not every time, because I've had situations where kids were bigger than me, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, they were special needs or whatever, dealing with different things. But with a use of force, you need to make sure that, and we've kind of alluded to it already, you need to make sure that you can adequately and if you need to, you can adequately handle that level and understanding of what that level would be. So
yeah, I think it's absolutely critical. Can I just say real quick? It's absolutely critical that you determine and assess the situation and determine, is this child actually assaulting you and trying to attack you or just lashing out in anger? Because there's a difference.
Yeah.
You're still being hit, but the intent behind it is going to be different. Is this person actually trying to assault you and attack you because they're trying to inflict harm on you, or are they just lashing out in anger and just trying to get you to get away for whatever reason? I think it's very critical, because that will shape, and it should shape, your response to what follows next and your attitude. Go ahead, yeah. Mike.
I mean, it could be even an accident. I mean, if they're involved in an altercation with another child, and all of a sudden you step into the room and you're trying to step between them, and then you get hit as a course of being in the midst of that, well, you kind of knowingly walked into it, one. So again, that intent was for that child to hit the other. Yes, there's still intent of harm, and yes, our job is still to intervene. But again, that degree of force, that degree of what the courts and everybody call is reasonableness, is it reasonable for the amount of force that you're uh-huh. using to uh-huh. be necessary in that uh-huh. situation? So under the same circumstances, under the same situation, meaning the same type of assault or situation that you're intervening, would somebody perhaps hasn't run across the church, that may not be in uniform, is it reasonable for that person to use that same degree of force? That's one of the big pieces that we would be held to as a standard if you mm-hmm. if you engage. But I just want to clarify, because we're talking about children and so forth. So I think that there's a difference, is that under 10 by circumstances is considered a child by the law. When mm-hmm. you're 10 to 16, you're considered a juvenile. And John would know this. I mean, that's where you can be arrested and held by juvenile court. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference that when you cross that threshold of 10, the level of responsibility and duty as that child or juvenile is greater. So where is that line and understanding what that can be? So somebody under 10 is a lot different in dealing with them and what their intent even is behind the circumstance mm-hmm. than say somebody who's 16, who might even be bigger than you as an adult, and is aggressively acting out. And now it becomes not just you're intervening to prevent harm to someone else. Now you're doing self-defense because you're in a mismatched situation. That's a whole different ballgame.
Yep. I've seen news headlines, two or three officers beat down a 14 or 15 year old. And of course, everyone's immediate image is of some young 14-year-old, little skinny, scrawny kid, when in fact this kid at age 15 was already 6-something and 200-some pounds. You know, there are some big kids out there, future, you know, football linebackers and volleyball, basketball players and stuff like that. Very large. You're absolutely right, Mike. I've encountered people 12, 13, 14 years old that I thought were a lot older, because they were my size and beefed up and so on. Yep. And so, yeah, that absolutely is going to play into, how you handle a situation. But again, basic primal human psychology. If you don't look like a threat to someone, they're less likely to escalate the situation. You can begin the de-escalation process. The things you say, the things you do, it's all the same, but it requires you to have the self-discipline not to become jacked up, offended, frustrated, impatient with the situation, and be careful with your tone of voice and how you come across to people. Especially children, because just someone that you perceive as being a younger person, someone who should be paying respect to you because you're the elder, you're the older, you're the senior, you're the adult.
Yeah,
it's hard because I think both of you guys have heard the scenario, but there was a situation where an individual, a child at our church, decided that they were going to be disruptive, and they were asked to stop. And it came to our attention later that the child was actually a special needs autistic boy. And it was the same thing. I want to say he was like 13, 12 or 13 in that age range, and really big kid. And so the pastor and I actually removed him from the classroom. We're walking down the hall. We're talking with him, just the two of us. We're, you know, trying to de-escalate and calm him down. And I'm not really sure what it was, because I wasn't doing a whole lot of talking. Our pastor does a phenomenal job with de-escalation, and especially special needs kids. And we sat down, like the three of us sat down in the entryway to the church, and all of a sudden the kid jumped up and started running into the plate glass window next to the front of the church. And he was like throwing himself into the window. And so the pastor like jumped up and came behind him and grabbed his belt, you know, and grabbed his pants and kind of pulled him back away from the window and said, "Hey, let's talk, let's sit down." You know, we were sitting down. Well, I don't want to. Then he turns around and he starts like throwing arms and punching. And this is a big kid. And so the pastor says, "Okay, well, let's go outside and sit on the front porch and do that and, address things accordingly." And so the two of us walked outside. Well, as the child sat down on the front steps, he started basically making very, very blunt accusations and statements about what he was going to do to the pastor and I, about, you know, making sure that we were unalived. And it wasn't like, "Hey, I'm going to kill, you know, I'm going to kill you." It was, "Hey, I'm going to do A, B, C, D, demonstrating intent, and watch you bleed out and die." I mean, it was extremely graphic. And that was the point where the pastor looked over at me and I said, "We need more than what we have right here." Uh-huh. And he kind of nodded his head, and I pulled out my phone and I dialed 911. And because we couldn't, as a church, we're responsible for that child because the mom and the adults aren't there. So we have a responsibility to protect that child and help that child. And I felt like this train was about to go off the rails. That's where we were at. And so I picked up my phone. I called 911. I said, "Could you please send an officer out to handle and help us with this situation?" And the dispatcher was phenomenal. She said, "Okay, we have an officer responding." The officer responded, did a fantastic job, took the child home. Just having the police car there was, again, another de-escalation for the child. But what was amazing and very impressed, what impressed me in the situation was that they intentionally pulled an officer out of the district that had special training with special needs, because I communicated that to the dispatcher and said, this is what we have going on. And so that officer had spent, I think, a 2-day training class with going through in the best way to handle it. And he did a phenomenal job and he helped in that situation. So I guess, you know, and I'll throw it over to you, John. But I like to at least talk for a second about, you know, knowing your boundaries and knowing your limits, and it, there's nothing wrong with at some point asking for extra help. And what is that point?
And that's up to you in the moment to maintain that situational awareness and self-discipline to recognize, okay, this is beyond me, before you get sucked down this rabbit hole and start debating and arguing with a child that's not at a place to be able to have a rational conversation with you. It's called CIT training in the law enforcement world, crisis intervention training. And it is a 2-day course. We've actually hosted that at our church, where law enforcement from all over would come in and spend 2 days going through different scenarios and all. It's effective, as you saw, and I'm glad more departments are beginning to do that. But back to your question, that is why I'm always advocating, whether you're dealing with a child or an adult, slow down and assess the situation, which will be which will be evolving right before your eyes. Recognize that you're not a specialist. No matter how well intentioned you are, you've got to recognize that maybe you're not doing you're not affecting some positive change. Like Mike said earlier, maybe for whatever reason, this person does not like you. It could be the color of your shirt, the color of your hair, or lack of hair. I mean, it could be something like that that just triggers them, or they just decide they don't like you. You've got to be able to determine that and just break contact, hand it over to a colleague, or call, you know, 911, and hopefully they send a CIT trained officer over there to take over the conversation.
For sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in all this, we have to understand that, you know what, the aggressive behavior by a child in a church situation is likely extremely rare. Okay, but it does indicate that the child is in distress in some degree. So whether that's a home situation, whether there's some sort of mental illness, whether it's just a child lashing out, as John said, the aggressive type behavior of actually being a threat to themselves or others should be extremely rare. So as a result, any use of force that we have involving children or juveniles, as we mentioned, those should be, of course, a extremely rare situation. So digging further into the use of force, again, I mentioned reasonableness before. And again, it's the purpose of preventing that child or juvenile from continuing to do or doing something. And that those something might be there. Some sort of physical offense. They're causing personal injury or damaging the property of the church. They're about to threaten themselves, etc. Those are all areas that are potentially things that we are going to have some level of involvement with. So there could be something that triggered them, as again, as I mentioned before, but we got to understand, what are we walking into? Either way, we're held to that reasonableness standard, and we might just decide. I know sometimes the best situation is not to even get involved because it might actually be a problem. And we have to every time decide whether that makes sense to actually engage at all. So, I mean, are they in distress? Are they engaging in self-harm? Are they acting in ways that could cause injury to themselves or others? That's really the critical standard by which we have to decide, should we even be engaging at all in that circumstance? So that's super important, deciding at that point. Now, do we have a reasonable belief? Meaning, are we seeing kind of done an assessment really on the situation? And based on how we've evaluated, would a reasonable person in the same reasonable circumstances with the comparable level of training that we have, which may be little to none, okay, would they expect to react in a similar fashion? That's what we're going to be handled to. So again, this is one of those areas. If they cross that line, we're there to act. That's our job. But we got to be really, really, really careful that
absolutely
they truly cross that line before we even
absolutely
think about getting involved.
Absolutely. And one thing always asking people, can you articulate imminent danger of great bodily harm or death before you quote unquote go hands on, before you intervene? Slow down and absolutely right. Do I really need to engage? Do I really need to make contact? Because not doing anything but standing back and being a good witness is absolutely a good option also, depending on the situation. Absolutely.
Well, the other aspect of that too, to throw in there, is not only to Mike's point, not only do we have an obligation to do that for ourselves, but we have an obligation to do that for everyone on our team. Mm-hmm. So if you have training, but folks on your team do not, mm-hmm. you still, as a leader, you still have an obligation to make sure that they are checking themselves as well and saying, okay,
absolutely.
You know, and I've been involved in situations and different scenes where I have stepped over to someone else that, again, meant harm or meant well in the situation. But honestly, they had no clue what they were doing. And that became very evident very quickly. And so I stepped in and I said, okay, there's enough people here. I need you to go wait for the police to get here, or go stand at the corner and flag down the, you know, emergency vehicles when they get here, or find something else to do to distract that person. But sometimes you need to step in when the person thinks, well, I read a book on this, I'm okay. And it's like, you read a book on this, but no, you're not okay. You don't know how to succinctly do this. You haven't been through CIT training or some other form of
or gentle response training.
Connect it. Yeah. Connect, you know, or gentle response training. There you go.
Right,
something where you can, something where you can connect to that you had knowledge given from a professional.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And shameless plug, I just held up John's book for those that are not watching the video version, Gentle Response Conflict Escalation with a Ministry Mindset. Get your copy on Amazon. I certainly am deep into reading it, but not done yet. But it's a great read. Glad you finally got that out there, John.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Thank you. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. I was going to go into kind of use cases. We've talked a lot of kind of theoretical, what might this look like and what might be walking into. So really situations that might have kind of escalated to a point where, you know, there's a direct threat where we now have to remove the child from the classroom itself. So that could be an example. Where we're preventing a child from leaving, like they're wanting to run out of the campus, and it's either kids church in the morning or maybe it's a youth night, and they're trying to disappear and go off with a boyfriend or girlfriend or this, that, or the other thing. There may be a situation where, you know, again, James mentioned it, we're responsible for that child, that juvenile. And at that point, you know, preventing that child from leaving is a risk of harm to themselves. And so we may have to step in that circumstance. And of course, preventing a child from attacking another child, or maybe it's a member of the staff or a member of your team, whatever, or even trying to harm themselves. I mean, there can be circumstances you come across that you're walking into the bathroom and you face that and realize, hey, this kid is doing something, and you have to intervene in those circumstances. And I think really under the most unlikely of circumstances, though, is if somebody says, hey, Johnny has a gun or Johnny has a knife, very well could have brought a BB gun to school, could have brought his dad's knife to school, whatever it might be. Obviously, that's not fruitful to have in the classroom or at church at all. So we may have to go hands-on to search for an item like a weapon. And so those are some example use cases that now says, okay, when it's met that standard, that's reasonable. Those are reasonable things by which we can intervene, that we could articulate, as John mentioned, that then we can actually do something with a level of responsible or reasonable force to engage that child.
Yep. And the trick is that's exactly right. But those are almost easy handed on a plate to you. This is a very right. The trick is when you're only dealing with someone who's having a temper tantrum or building up to a temper tantrum, how do you de-escalate that, cause a distraction before it becomes a temper tantrum? Because like I said earlier, once it gets to this peak emotional state, you're along for the ride. I mean, we've lost that opportunity. That's why it's situational awareness, is recognizing that something might be stirring, might be escalating. What are the things that you can say or do to mitigate that? I want to share some case stories, some examples, because we've talked about some really awesome theoretical stuff, but how does it look in real life, in real situations? If I could just share real quick, a couple years ago, a 7-year-old girl had a temper tantrum, throwing things around. This was during second service. The teacher ended up grabbing the other kids and left the girl in the room, because just for everyone else's safety. Girl had a meltdown, not exactly sure what triggered it. She went over, locked the door, and then began to pile tables, chairs, and debris all in one corner of the room. Our pastor, our children's pastor, opened the door with his key, walked in. She's tearing up the place, yelling, screaming, and he sits in the middle of the room and sits cross-legged and doesn't say anything. And she looks at him, continues to throw chairs around, and then she looks at him again, and she goes, "Aren't you going to do anything?" And he goes, "No, you go ahead. We'll talk when you're done." Because he recognizes if he tries to, you know, she wasn't doing anything at that time. She wasn't a danger to herself. She was just ranting and venting. And we got insurance. We can get new chairs. We can get new tables. But as it is, nothing was broken. It just piled up into the corner. But he could also tell she was beginning to come down because she had expended all this energy. He said that after a while, about 15, 20 minutes, next thing you know, she's sitting cross-legged across from them. They're holding hands and they're praying. But he gave her that space and time to burn off that energy. But I've seen other adults get frustrated, impatient, offended, and go in there, "Hey, you need to stop what you're doing," and just... not necessarily the wrong in that we want the child to stop tearing up the and I say tearing up, but again, nothing was actually being broken. Not actually wrong that we want the child to stop this, but how we approach that could have escalated the situation with our tone of voice and him taking a seat so that he's not looming over her, looking like a bigger threat to her. So he's not inadvertently triggering her fear aggression. He just sat right down, eye level. And actually, you see a lot of parents, a lot of people seem to instinctively know this. Even when they're disciplining their child, they know to get down eye level. And all of us have been in that situation where we start getting jacked up and we want to emphasize a point to our child. Now we stand up to loom over them, because deep down inside, we already know if we can let this person know that we're bigger, badder, meaner than them, it can intimidate them. But for a younger person, depending on their frame of mind, you looming over them could trigger that defensive mechanism and fear aggression. And Pastor Jesse knew to just sit down. So that's one example of a 7-year-old child making a mess of things, having a temper tantrum, but giving, by that time, it had just exploded. So just give her the time to burn it off, and then it resolved itself.
That actually similar to that, we had a situation where we had a 5-year-old that was throwing himself around and at vacation Bible school. And we decided to take him home because he wasn't listening. And, you know, he was throwing himself around. And so we put him in the van to take him home and buckled him. And, you know, our church policy is always to go with two people. And so somebody needed to sit next to him and that sort of thing. And he, when we actually put him in the van, he was still fighting. He was still throwing himself, you know, trying to do that. And of course, as I'm buckling his seatbelt, he decides that he's going to bite me and bite my hand. And I just held him, you know, put my arms around him, kept my hand away from his face, his mouth, and just said, "Okay," you know, and I just sat there with him. And within probably about 60 seconds, he had gotten to that point where, and I wasn't forceful. I was just giving him a big, you know, a bear hug, just, you know, containing him to the vehicle. and not to biting me or the driver. And he wore himself out. And at that point, he was just like, you know, a limp banana. He's like, okay, you know, I can't fight anymore. I can't, you know, and goes through a different phase, obviously a different phase of action and consideration. But sometimes doing that, you know, is the best course. Like, property's property. It, yes, you know, it's the church's, but at the same point, be graceful and understand that, you know what, in the scheme of things, that's not where the value is. The value is actually trying to help the child. So, well, I'll throw it over to Mike and we'll wrap up this session. So,
yeah, I mean, I could talk probably for another hour on this topic. I definitely did kind of some digging, and I talked with my sergeant. I'm a volunteer at my police department, and talked with him over this topic, talked to a couple of other people, and really kind of dug in. So really passionate about it, but really want to transition. So now you've heard a whole lot. Your brain is probably spinning. So now you're thinking, okay, what are we going to do? How do we implement something, some sort of protocol at our church? How do we approach this? So I'm going to go through a list relatively rapid fire, probably see this in a future blog. But ultimately, you want to start really with an absolute policy of kind of exclusion from this type of engagement initially, until you have a chance to really decide and understand how you're going to approach it. Start with saying, we acknowledge that we're not prepared for it, and put that into place. Second is establish a defined oversight process, or a leader in your church, maybe not the pastor, but who's going to be oversight for very specifically, maybe it's a kid's pastor, maybe it's another leader, but define some oversight that's going to be some additional iron sharpens iron wisdom in this circumstance that is not just you as leadership of your safety team. Contact your insurance company and legal representation. There is a whole host of things. We hit it off at the beginning of the episode, talking about figure out and do some research into your state laws and policies and things around that. Understand what that looks like. Talk with your local police department. Understand how they handle force and kids and so forth in the district specifically that your church may be in. Four, creating a thorough policy around the use of force. You may already have something in place, but may not have thought of it as to applying to how you would engage with children or juveniles in this sense. So revise or create a policy around the use of force. Five, work through steps to include kind of or opt in specific individuals on your team. Understand who are the type and caliber of folks most likely to be able to de-escalate somebody, has maybe already have some skills in that sense, are best working with kids. Maybe they're already working dual role and they serve in kids ministry, but also serve on the safety team. That may be an opportunity to incorporate those individuals. Start there, start small. Seek out specialty training. It's really a non-negotiable. Talk to this guy right here. Okay, reach out to John, because de-escalation training really is absolutely mandatory. Honestly, I don't know how you can operate a safety team in a church situation, okay, without getting de-escalation training, period, full stop. And that's not just because John's on the air. That's not just because he's a friend. I really believe that that's our only way and safe path forward as a church safety team, period. Number eight. Crafting behavioral strategies to really avoid crisis in which your restraint or other sorts of hands-on could even be used. Try to prevent it from even getting to that point. Make sure you're involving your kids' team so that they try to de-escalate, so that they never even have to call you. That's a good day. Number nine, establish a structure with a variety of supports and contingency plans. Be prepared right off the bat. Just like James said, go in with two in the van. You got to make sure you're going in with two from your safety team to the situation and responding in that situation. Maybe it's not somebody's who's on the safety team. Maybe it's just somebody who's an extra person who can dial 911 in case it escalates. But you got to bring somebody other than the kid's teacher, who could be out of commission from being hit, any number of reasons. Bring another person in there and make sure you have that contingency plan in place. Number 10, always debrief. Understand that after any incident, any use of force, any certain time, whether little or whether big, if you used restraint, if you used any sort of circumstance, a debrief is absolutely non-negotiable. And then, of course, you've got to inform the parents right off the bat, make sure it's in any sort of check-in policy, make sure it's in any sort of sign over that says under a last resort intervention, including hands-on use of force, may be used to prevent harm. So let them acknowledge it's not that you have to legally do so. It's just you're being a good steward of your church in informing them. And finally, if you've gone through that process and you had to use force and the parent was not there, obviously get them there as soon as you can. But the parents have to be informed immediately. It is not, oh, crap, what did we do? Then inform them. It's inform them. Your discussion with the parents and about the incident, you need to inform them out of kind of outlining a couple of things. The child's behavior that led to this, the level of risk presented at the time, the nature of the force that was used by your safety team member that was deemed relevant and reasonable, and why it was reasonable, and any subsequent effect that you saw in the fallout after that use of force. We must absolutely then transition from force as fast as possible to empathy and compassion, because it's still a child. We're still in ministry. It's still our church. And that's it.
Outstanding.
I'm out of
ammo. that's good. That's good. Yeah.
I'm going to go back to number seven, because I was actually writing notes while you did that. I mean, I could hit, John and I both could probably go back through every,
that was a good list.
But I'm gonna go back to seven, because I think that wraps up things nicely, Mike. And you know, a lot of times I talk to churches and they'll say, you know, and we've all had this discussion before, like, what's the most important thing as a safety team can you learn or train or do? And oftentimes, you know, they'll gravitate and say, well, I'm gonna go do firearm training, or I got my CCW permit, or that sort of thing. And oftentimes, more often than not, I will stop them and say, no, that's not the most important training you can do. The most important training that you can do to invest in yourself as an individual and to invest in your church and your team is de-escalation training. There's no two ways around it, because in all honesty, de-escalation training doesn't just help you with the emergency mitigation and situations that you deal with as a safety team, it helps you in life. You know, we've both been on here, all three of us have been on here before, talking about how in everyday life, those principles helped us be successful and, you know, and stay on track with the situation that we were involved in at the time. So it's not just a, hey, train your team. It's a, hey, you know what? If your kids' ministry deals with kids, then guess what? That training should be incorporated for all of those teachers, because this is something as a society that we're lacking. And it doesn't mean that the individual that you have as a Sunday school teacher isn't a good person with good intentions. What it means is that every person can do better, be better, interact with others in a better way. And you know, coming out of COVID, regardless of what the stats are, we all need to learn how to interact better with others, because for 2 years we spent basically, you know, hidden in our house, like hiding from everybody,
like mushrooms.
And we've all forgotten how this works. So, you know what? The first training, foremost, most important training that you should be focused on is some type of de-escalation training. If it's not with John and his awesome team, then, you know, find someone local that does hands-on scenario, not lecture, scenario-based training. And, you know, maybe contact John, because he and his team travel all over. But you don't need someone lecturing you on what to do or what not to do. You can get that off of a YouTube video or reading a book, but you need to have the actual scenarios in front of you to learn. And, you know, John and I were talking about this last week, and, you know, this is it. I'll wrap up. But, you know, the truth is we're all scared of situations. But when you have the scenarios, when you do the scenarios, you learn, and it eliminates the fear, because now you're better prepared to be able to jump into a situation and say, okay, I know how to do this. I have the self-confidence to be successful because I went through this training and I did that and I came out better for it on the other side. And, yep. You know, doing, again, having teachers, having anyone in a child-based ministry go through that, even potentially having, you know, if your church cross trains hospitality folks or ushers or deacons to interact with people, any ministry that interacts with people can benefit from it. So without any more shameless plugs or further eloquence, you are, I think John's phone is about dead.
Yep. Well, we can wrap up with our usual.
I'll pull him out. But yeah, definitely we'll wrap up. Come check out our website, churchsafetyguys.com. If we can help you out, if we can be of benefit, come visit us in Austin, Texas at the Church Security Essentials Conference. Love to talk to you. Still have tickets. They're selling out quickly. You can get tickets through our website, which is churchsafetyconference.com. And I'll let you know, John is actually going to be one of the speakers there on Saturday and helping us out with some other things during the week. You don't want to miss it. So until next time, take care. God bless. We hope you have a great upcoming Easter season, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you for joining the Church Safety Guys broadcast, brought to you by Vigilant Impact. We hope that you found it informative, and we appreciate your feedback and interaction. Be sure to share our broadcast with your teams, join the discussion online, and connect with us on social media or at our website at churchsafetyguys.com. For other great ministry resources, download the Church Security app. Remember, keep a servant's heart, a mindset of ministry, and semper disciplina. Always be training. Have a blessed week.